All right, great to see everyone. Good evening. Looking forward to learning with you tonight. To conclude our series on medical halacha, Jewish medical ethics, I really thought it was important to spend, to dedicate one session to issues in mental health, mental illness, because it's something, first of all, it's something that there's a stigma around, and I think it's important to talk about it, because people don't feel comfortable talking about it, but these are things that are very, very common, that people deal with very frequently, and that it's worth spending some time talking about and exploring. I also want to make it clear that, you know, the issues that we'll be sharing tonight, we're going to kind of jump around. Basically, it's based on the areas that I have had the opportunity to deal with the most. So it's just basically personal things in my work that I've encountered. There's source sheets right here, Johnny, right here, and there's some source sheets there. Welcome. So the things I've chosen are based on what I've encountered the most frequently, and they're very diverse. So I don't want anyone to think that, like, I've chosen topics and I'm comparing topics. It's almost like in a medical ethics sheer, we might talk about flu and broken bones and cancer all in, you know, it doesn't mean that there's a comparison between them or that I'm, you know, so we're going to talk about a wide variety of things. And I want to just share some basic issues that come up in for those who are concerned with following Jewish law as they encounter these issues. What are some of the issues? And so we'll just run through five or six different areas. So the first thing I want to share with you, and we're going to get more practical, but I want to start off on a conceptual level, on like a lumdus level, like theoretical level, because this actually is going to inform everything we're going to say. And this piece here, for me, as someone who works in a field that deals with mental health and tries to put it in the context of Jewish law, when I saw this piece that we're going to look at right now together, it totally shifted the way I saw Jewish law and its impact on treatment of mental illness. And the truth is, once I realized this, what we're going to read together, when I started asking rabbis questions or researching issues that arose, I began to notice code words. And when certain things would come up or certain gemaras would be quoted, you could see already where it's going to go. Kind of like when we started out the first night, the first year we had, if you remember, just like this little chazara, I pointed out that those rabbis which quote, if you ask about end-of-life issues, and a rabbi quotes to the Gemara in Yuma, that you can violate Shabbos even to save a life of someone who's dying anyways. Usually they're going more towards the direction of the infinite value of life, and we do everything to prolong life. Whereas if someone begins by quoting the story, Ksubas, of the Amsa de Be'erebi, the death of Rabbeinu HaKadosh, the holy author of the Mishnah, you know that usually they're going towards a perspective that's oftentimes sees life as being of relative value, of course, incredibly valuable, but might be more likely to permit passively allow someone to die. So just like there's those two approaches, so too in mental health. So if you turn the page, the first page here, you see it says Shota on the top of the page. This is from the Encyclopedia Hilchatit Refuit, Dr. Avram Steinberg, who won the Pras Yisrael for this book. It's an incredible book. So you see a little check mark by that. That's from my own copy at home, so it's a little bit faded there. But the check mark where it says Geder Pekuach Nefesh. So I'm going to try not to do too much reading inside in the Hebrew today. I want to have more discussion and just share personal anecdotes. But I feel like this is an important source to share. So I'll read it to you and I'll translate. But this is very, very fundamental. So the question is going to be, you know, is mental illness, is this considered like a chole? Is this an illness for which one could violate Shabbos or any other prohibition to protect someone who's suffering from mental illness? Just like if someone is, God forbid, in a car crash or something else, and you see them on the street, and you can do something to save their life. So, of course, you do anything you can to save life. But what about if it's a mental illness and not a physical illness? Does Jewish law bring it to that same level of urgency? So there's two approaches. So, you don't mind passing the source sheet here? So it says, so we're on page one. These are my little numbering system here. Page one. So it says, Maniat machlat nefesh, preventing mental illness. V'hatzala mipnei hitpachtut machlazu, and preventing it from spreading. Nechshevet kamatzav shebekuach nefesh. It is indeed considered by Jewish law to prevent mental illness, life-saving. Kuach nefesh. Lefikach, therefore, mutter lechal el Shabbos la'avor al Yisurim. It's therefore permissible to violate Shabbos or other prohibitions, Kedei lahatzil adam mimachlas nefesh, to save someone suffering from mental illness. You can indeed override prohibitions, even in the Torah, as we will discuss, to protect someone or save them from a mental illness. However, now we get to the specifics. Achein, we need to know how it works. Kayemet chakira basisit b'sheila. There is a fundamental understanding. Ima heter la'avor al yisurim midin b'koach nefesh, hu mipnei achasha shechol b'machla nefshit alula agia b'lamatzav shal b'koach nefesh gufani. Is it because we're trying to save them from hurting themselves? Kugon al yedei pegia ba'atzmo adhistavdus, like they're going to maybe kill them, do something that could kill themselves? Or sheyachol lidboa b'nar, or lipol amavis, they could fall and hurt themselves? Oh, now turning the page, al yedei pegia ba'acherim ad la'arigar. Maybe they're going to hurt someone else, because they're not in control of themselves, and they're going to do something to hurt somebody else. So therefore, it's kind of like saying, according to that approach, that we care about mental illness, but only because it's also physical, going to hurt us physically. That's one approach, right? Or shemutar la'avor li'asurim kedei limnoa machlat nefesh kedei la'afshar la'adam liyot pikeach u'likayim mitzvot ba'atiyah. Or do we care about preventing the spread of mental illness and even violating prohibitions to protect someone's mental health, because we are concerned about that person themselves and their ability to be focused and fulfill mitzvot and to be a functioning member of society? Right? There's two very different, right? You can have huge nafkaminas, very big practical differences. Right? Here he gives an example here. Hahevdo beinehem, the difference is nogea lemachlat nefesh shebehen ein chashash l'alimut. What if someone has a mental illness, but they're not going to hurt anybody as a result? There's not going to be violence. Ach adam b'matzav zeh eino bar kosher shifut. But they don't have mental capacity. Right? Someone is not able to function in society, but they're not going to hurt anybody. So according to the first approach, you might say, well, you know, they're not going to hurt themselves or anybody else, so I can't violate Shabbos or anything else to help them. I want to help them, but it doesn't override anything else because they're not going to hurt themselves. That would be, or do we say, no, we care about a person being able to function, and therefore it doesn't matter if they're not going to hurt themselves. We want to do whatever we can. So he goes on. This is important here too. Beinah poskim, between the rabbinic authorities, matzinu misha hidgishu shagadaras shotem ibechina pikoch nefesh hu davka machmas asakana gufanit shebematzav zeh. Some of the poskim, some of the rabbinic authorities say it's only because of the physical damage they might do to themselves or someone else. Umishum chavivus gufu shal adam miYisrael, and because of the holiness that we have, that we want to prevent someone from being hurt. And tamam, what's their source in the Torah? Geder aheter bikuach nefesh umishum v'chai behem v'loshi yamus behem. This is a classic verse in the Torah, right? We want to live by them and not die by the mitzvot. And so therefore, if we can prevent someone from dying, then we do whatever we can. But it's only if they're gonna, God forbid, die or cause someone else to. Umashma shedavka matzavim hamivim lemisa. Only if they could possibly die as a result. That's one approach. However, there's another approach. This is the approach that seems to me to be the approach that the majority of poskim take. And in the situations that I've had, that I'm going to share some of them tonight, it seems that they've all taken this approach. The other approach is, v'yesh ha-sovrim, some say, shigam kedei sheyishmor shabbatot mitzvot ba'atid. We want to be able to, observe Shabbos, observe Judaism, observe life in the future. Therefore, mutter la'avor l'yisurei Torah l'chala Shabbos. You can violate Shabbos. Tamam. Their source is la'alach and nishar gam hatam shal v'chai behem. Of course, we have v'chai behem, but we also have v'gam hatam shal chalal l'av Shabbos achas kedei sheyishmor shabbosos harbe. We also have a concept, though, that you can violate one Sabbath to be able to observe many Sabbaths, right? So the way this comes out in the Lumdus, and I'll just give away one of the later sources, but this is so important. And this is what Rav Asher Weiss shared with me in a few cases that I had with him. And as soon as he quoted this concept, I knew where he was going to go with it because of having read this piece. So the Chassam Sofer has a brilliant idea. Chassam Sofer, one of the great rabbinic authorities. He quotes, there's a Gemara in Shabbos. Imagine the following case. Someone is stuck in the desert. They're lost in the desert, and they don't know what day of the week it is. They're in the desert, totally desert, and there's no iPhone, there's nothing, right? They're in the desert. So what do you do? Which day of the week do you observe Shabbos? So there's an opinion that you don't know which day it is, you observe Shabbos every day. It's every day might be Shabbos, so you do whatever you have to do to keep yourself alive, but you try to minimize any malacha, and you basically have to be concerned that every day might be Shabbos, except for one thing. There's one mitzvah of Shabbos, one prohibition that you completely ignore. Tchum. Because what would happen if you had to observe the Tchum Shabbos and you're lost in the desert? You'll never get out. If you had to observe it 7 days a week, you're stuck there. It's a death sentence. So the Chassam Sofer brilliantly says, okay, Tchum means, right, you can't go outside of the area where you're staying, especially when you're in the wilderness. So brilliantly he applied this to another case. The case was somebody who was living in Europe, and there was in Vienna, in a far-off place, this person had a severe mental illness, a child, and there was an institution where he could be institutionalized, but they had no kosher food there. So the question was, do we leave him here at home where he's not going to get better? Or do we send him there where he will get better, but he's going to be eating non-kosher food? So the Chassam Sofer applies this concept. And he says, well, what, you want him to be stuck here forever, never being able to do a mitzvah? He'll go there, he'll have to eat non-kosher food for a little while, but then he will grow and mature and be able to then keep all the whole Torah in the future. In the end, he actually does not go that way. He then gets concerned about the concept of Timtum Alev, that eating non-kosher food has an impact on our soul, and so he gets concerned about that. But he uses this reasoning that you can violate one Shabbos in order to observe many Shabboses, and therefore we see a much more expansive approach to treating someone with mental illness, because it's not just to prevent them from dying or killing somebody, but it's because of the value that we place on trying to enable them to observe mitzvot and to live a productive life. Right? So this is the fundamental chakira underlying the whole discussion. Right? So we can take an approach where we can actually violate some mitzvot in order to help somebody because we care about their mental well-being. So let me give you a couple examples. My favorite one is on page 3, an incredible example. Absolutely, and not only do I find it incredible, but maybe like some of you parents here can relate to it a little bit. I'm wondering if I should just tell you the story or read it to you inside. Reading it gives it so much more. I feel like it really brings it to life. In this case, let's read it. So on the bottom right-hand side of page 3, this is the Nishmas Avram, which we've studied from a lot in this series, Dr. Abraham and Yerushalayim. So he has the following question. Imagine this question. It's a 9-year-old child with severe autism. Autism kashe. So you see from the parenthesis, picks up. Medubar b'yelad she'enu medaber klal. He can't speak. Enu mesachek mitkasher itanu. He can't play or even have a connection with us. With b'nei mishpachto. Rak l'gabi rotzono sava basisim. Just with his basic needs, he can communicate. But not much communication. Lamasha, for example, kasher munyan lachol or lishto, he wants to eat or drink, or let's say lachater, go outside and play, gedoma, hu moshech, hu masbir bedarko es ritzono. He's able to move himself around and explain what he wants and make it clear what he wants. Matzav rucho ole v'yored la'itim, hu ninuach ach la'itim, hu me'od atzuv. But sometimes he can barely move, he's rogez, he's angry, lachutz, he's anxious. V'az kemuvan, shekol habayis ha'achim va'anu ha'horim, his brothers, our whole house, his family, the parents, omdim bechuser onim. We have no strength, we're struggling, it takes up the whole family. Masha margioso, but there's one thing that makes him feel good. B'miuchad, ze yetzia achutza v'nesia ba'oto. If you take him for a ride in the car, he's calm. Right? I don't know if any of your children that can't go to sleep unless you do this. Pa'amim rabot anu nosim kilometrim. Sometimes we drive him kilometers. B'gedei lahargi oto, just to calm him down, kimat kol erev. Just about every night, near dam rak benesia. He only falls asleep riding in the car. V'leilot rabim kasher hu mit'orer marsha margi oto mibechi v'zam. The only thing that calms him down is the drive in the car. Now, this is okay. This is if that's how you have to live your life. That's how you have to live your life. It's not a halachic problem, except for one day a week. What's going to happen? What's the problem? Shabbos. You drive him every night. The only way you get him to sleep is taking him for a drive. What are you going to do on Shabbos, though? You have a long Friday night. What could you do? Put him in the stroller. Apparently, the stroller's not good enough. There is a difference between the stroller and a car. You know, driving the car, it's much more relaxing. Right, he's 9 years old. That's true, right. But even the strollers, right. On a gravel road, really fast. So look at his answer. And his answer then is supported by Rav Neuvert, the author of the Shmir Shabbos. Because when I told my wife this, she said, oh, come on, who said that? What did he about to say? And I said, how about Rav Neuvert, the author of the Shmir Shabbos Kilchasa? So she said, oh, Right? So she says, Anisi lo, I answered, Shekol zman shelo medubar al pekuach nefesh. Okay, if it's not pekuach nefesh, ain't kohetzer lechal shabbos be'isurei Torah al deyudi. I can't see how we could, you know, a Jew could violate a Torah prohibition. It's not really saving his life. However, achie mutter lesader meirosh, you could prepare ahead of time. Gam goy sheyaskim lavo lekachat et hayelad, a non-Jew will come to drive him. Yachad ito im ishto, also with the parents, right? Or another child sibling. Im kein dorish haben. So he goes on there, but so you can actually prepare. So you're violating a rabbinic prohibition. But can you violate a prohibition for such a case? So look in the footnote. This is to me where it's revolutionary. It says, footnote 82, Kechol chole kol haguf, shemutel levakesh migoy lechalas haShabbos. We are now considering someone who has a mental, a sort of a, you know, this in this case, autism, is considered also like, we're comparing it to a chole kol haguf. It's a radical comparison. That now this is like someone who is physically ill, and there is a system of laws in the Torah of how we treat that, and even though we can't violate a Torah prohibition for it, we can violate rabbinic prohibitions, and we can have a non-Jew drive him in the car. Incredible, no? I found that psak to be just amazing. I happened to read an interesting tshuva this week. Listen to this one. We're jumping to different subjects, but Rav Zilberstein in B'nai Brak was asked the following question. This is a real B'nai Brak question. There's a boy in yeshiva who's ADHD. He is not succeeding in yeshiva. He can't sit and learn. He can't focus. He needs lots of breaks. Eventually, he just, you know, yeshiva's not for him. He ends up, he's on the streets. And finally, he has a yeshiva who's able to pull him back in. And the way they do it is they have one guy there who he connects with. And he finally says, you know what, you have someone you connect with, I'm going to dedicate this guy to you, and you'll take a lot of breaks, you have to spend a lot of time just talking, and you'll get a little bit of learning done. But if this guy, you found someone you connect with, and it's working, and he's learning, he's back in yeshiva. But now the other guy, who he's learning with, sends a letter to Rav Zilberstein. You know, it's not fair. Rebbe, I've been doing this now for a couple of years, I'm not getting any learning done. It's helping him, but I have to sit there and talk to him, and we have to go for walks, and we barely get any learning done. It's not fair for me. Can I please stop and find him someone else? Reb Zilberstein responded, Lo Talmud Adam Reyacha. He is obligated to continue learning with him. Even though he's not getting much learning done, he's saving someone's life. Reb Nachum Rabinovich has an incredible tshuva in his most recent, in his Sefer of Shas and Tshuvas. What about a social worker? A social worker in Israel who gets a call that there was a bombing, God forbid. Can a social worker respond? Okay, we understand why a medic can respond. What about a social worker whose job it is to help people to calm down in the midst of the terror? But how could it be? It's not saving a life.
Yes, they do.
Well, yeah, so, what? Right, exactly. And even if they don't damage themselves, he writes, Rav Rabinovich, we have a concept of the suve daita, which is that if someone is already, you know, injured, mental anguish can make it worse, and calming someone down in the midst of their physical injury can literally save their lives. And he writes, a social worker gets a page or something on Shabbos that there's a bombing, should rush there right away and do whatever they can to help. Even though they're not a medic, but they should do whatever they can to help. It's incredible. Rav Moshe is quoted as paskin that someone, you know, we have name-changing ceremonies we sometimes do for someone who's very, very sick. He writes there that if it's a mental, this is not violating something, but it's just, I found it to be very interesting, that even for mental illness, he says, if someone feels a need to change the name, they could change the name for healing for mental illness as well. But there are many examples, I'm not going to go into many more now, but I just wanted to share some examples when the rabbis were very sensitive to the need to do whatever possible to help people suffering from a wide variety of emotional, mental challenges, even though they're not technically, this kid, you could have just said, okay, you know what, one day a week, one night a week, he'll just cry all night. We have to deal with it. But the rabbis didn't say that. It's very interesting, yeah.
What are you saying, his mental illness?
It's not exactly the same.
Psar, if this kid is in, the person with a capital psar from a physical illness, then basically
Well, we're comparing it. So in this case, we've compared it to chola kol aguf, to chola she'ein bo sakana. There are examples of how sick a person has to be, and we're making a comparison. We can't do it with every case. So for example, for depression, the rabbis do not say you can violate a Torah prohibition for depression. But if depression is factored in with another issue, with like a physical illness, then they are more willing. It depends on a case-by-case issue, and it requires someone who knows who knows what's going on. A lot of the post-gim, and we're going to see some examples, suggest to rabbis to be in touch with a mental health professional when making these decisions, because they have to determine how serious it is. If it's, even in this case, he makes clear to say it's autism kashe. What would he have said if it was mild autism? Maybe he would have said the same thing. So we have to be careful about how far we take this. And it's a case by case, and a person should ask their rabbi. But thank you for bringing that up, because I want to make it clear it's not just blanket permission, but I want to bring out the compassion and the understanding that rabbis are having for mental illness and comparing it to a physical illness, because we don't necessarily have these categories in halacha until the rabbis made it clear to make sure those categories were available. So let's take the next step. So that's background. That's all by way of introduction. This next piece, I don't want to spend too much time on it because I think it's obvious to people, but it's worth mentioning, which is, how is it permissible in the first place to speak to a therapist? Isn't there a prohibition against Lashon Hara? And isn't there going to be some Lashon Hara spoken in the context of a therapeutic encounter with a therapist? I mean, you're going to have to be... it's going to be very difficult to, a person has issues that they're going through. They're not going to be able to talk about other people. So this one's a rather simple one, because the Chafetz Chaim, in the classic work on the laws of gossip, of slander, of Lashon Hara, he mentions it specifically. And this source, this page here, any Orthodox therapist, this is their source for them, their ability to do their job. And so the Chafetz Chaim lists a number of conditions. If you want to talk about someone, it is possible, according to the laws of Lashon Hara, to talk about other people, but you have to follow a lot of rules. And one of those rules is, I think I underlined it there, on the top of the page, this is page 4, Prata Chamishi, Shechaven Letoelas. There has to be a reason, a purpose, that you are talking about another person. So when the Chafetz Chaim wrote this book, and he writes, you have to have a purpose, he put a little footnote there. See the star? Look at the star. The star says, what's the toels? What's the purpose? Besiparo, and you're telling the story, lahafeg edagato milibo, to remove the burden from your heart. That is considered toelas. That's a purpose. Havikimechavin the toelas Allah haba. This is what the Gemara says. It says, dagab levish yaschena. What does it mean, yaschena? It could either mean stuff it out, yaschena, or yasichena, or tell it, yasichena. Dr. Pelkovitz often quoting the study from 9/11, that people who survived 9/11, when they would tell over the story of their experience of surviving the World Trade Center and what it was like rushing down the stairs, they would do fMRIs, an MRI where they can see the action in a person's brain. And as they recounted the trauma, the communication centers in the brain shut down. And they realize that when a person is going through trauma, their ability to communicate is compromised. And through focusing on the act of talking it out is how a person heals. Healing comes through going through it and fixing that trauma, so to speak, in their brain. So the Chafetz Chaim here points out that removing worry from a person's heart is permissible. Now they have to follow all these rules here. So the rules are, they can't. They have to only be trying to relieve their concerns. So the test for that, for example, is if I'm trying to relieve my concerns, it should be certainly enough to just tell one person, to tell a therapist. If I see that I'm putting it on Facebook or something, announcing to the world, hey, guess what my friend did? He called him my friend. Look what he did to me. So that might not be really for the purpose of getting it off your chest. You didn't need to tell everyone in the world, right? You have to. You can't exaggerate. It says here, shelo yagdil havla. You can't exaggerate it. There has to be no other way of doing this. But as long as you follow all of these, also the therapists themselves, their purpose is not. The purpose isn't to gossip. The purpose is that they're trying to analyze what you're saying. So it's not that they're even necessarily believing you. They might be thinking to themselves, okay, I'll take it with a grain of salt, but I'm trying to understand how you interpreted and you saw what happened. So it's not, the point is not the gossip. The point is getting it off your chest, and therefore it's sort of permissible. But here's where it becomes more challenging. Okay, so that's allowed. And there's more. There's a lot of different theories. Chafetz Chaim, I think, is the most prominent, but there's others who have seen it as part of the tshuva process. Rabbi Levi Meir, Olav HaShalom at Cedar Sinai, used to say that tshuva, real repentance, is impossible without psychotherapy. To really do tshuva, you need psychotherapy. You need to talk it out and really analyze and work through things. And that was one of the things he used to really talk about. So Professor Moshe Levi Spiro, who's one of the big names in the Jewish psychotherapy world, has this whole model whereby he sees psychotherapy as vidui devarim. Part of the process of vidui, of tshuva, includes saying what you did wrong. So it's part of the tshuva process. There's different ways, but this is the Chafetz Chaim, that it's toelis. But how about this? Okay, so you're going to go to the therapist to talk. So now we see it's allowed. You can talk. But what if your problem is with your parents? You have an obligation, kibud av va'em. So you're going to go to your therapist to talk, but it can't be about your parents. Isn't it always about the parents, though? No, I'm joking. I'm joking. God forbid. Oh, man, now I just did it. Okay. That was a joke. But it sometimes is. Every now and then, it is the parents, right? Every once in a blue moon. So now what do? You want to go to someone to talk. You have to work through these issues, but it might include saying things about your parents that are not respectful. But it's part of your issues that you're dealing with. Look at this. This is on page 5 now. This is Rav Nissen Shlomo Kaplan from the Mir Yeshiva, one of the Rosh Yeshiva from the Mir Yeshiva, in a journal called Torah. He says there, I put an arrow there, in the middle there, and the first word in the line is al. So he says, Kishemisaper al avi ve'imo, if you're talking about your parents, haray over al mitzvah saseh shal kibura ve'im, you're violating the prohibition against the obligation of honoring your parents. The gama arur mekale avi ve'imo, and also, cursed will be the person that curses their parents. These things, there's, even if it's for a toelis, even if it's a purpose, you can't do it just because it's for a purpose. You can't just say, okay, I'm going to worship idols because it makes me feel good. It takes off my worries. You can never say that, right? You can never. Therefore, even if it's for a purpose, you can't talk about your parents. And in the Dati Leumi world, Rabbi Eliezer Melamed has a very similar psak, which says the same thing. So, you see, it's a halachic issue. So there's this interesting, I'll show you a couple things. There's an interesting little book that came out. I didn't copy it, put it in the source sheet. But Rishumi Aaron, this is Rabbi Aaron Felder. Aaron Felder was a Talmud in Philadelphia, a Talmud of Rav Moshe Feinstein. And he put together a book. Unfortunately, he died recently. But before he died, he put together all his notes of his questions he asked Rav Moshe Feinstein. And his quick answers. He jotted down his answers. And he happened to ask Rav Moshe this exact question. In fact, he asked Rav Moshe a lot of interesting questions. And they're all dealt with here. Unfortunately, very pithily. Is that a word? Pithy? In a very pithy fashion. Very, you know, one line. But look what he says here. Rav Moshe. So we have Rav Nissen Shlomo Kaplan. Rav Moshe says, or is quoted as saying, Afal pisha asr la'adam listor et divrei aviv, even though we're not supposed to contradict our parents, ulam, however, b'mikra shel refua psikiologit, when it comes to psychological therapy, nechshav letzorach refua umutter. Like we were saying before, it's refua. It's considered refua when it's for psychotherapy, and therefore, bilvad shelo ye b'derech b'zayon. Okay, you can't be belittling your parents, making fun of them, humiliating your parents. But if that's what you need to do for your therapy, to talk about your parents, it could be permissible. In fact, Rav Zilberstein was asked a few interesting questions. Go to page 6 now. I won't read them inside because I want to save time for the last few discussions, which I want to spend more time discussing. But his tshuvas on this are absolutely brilliant. He has one where he says, imagine the following case. It's not imagine. He includes the questions in his answer, so you can see who asked him. And a psychotherapist asked him the following question. He says, I have a treatment that, you know, I'm realizing could be problematic. But he writes there, I don't know if this is true, you'll tell me, that this has become a common therapy where people who are struggling with someone else, they have anger towards them. And part of the therapy is I want to get them to, like, express their anger. But not just a little bit, even to exaggerate it. and like just go crazy in my office, not in public, just in my office, just go crazy with anger at their parent or whoever it is. And even exaggerate, just talk about how they're the worst people ever and they're the cause of all your problems and curse them and do it. And this, I find, gets it out of their system and helps people overcome their anger at their parents. So he says, can I have people do this? This is like, they're really... So Rav Zilberstein there says, I mean, that's like really... So Rav Zilberstein says, if the parents sent them for therapy, like the parents clearly want them to get better, they don't know what they're going to be doing there, but the parents are the ones who sent them, you could do it. Because you can assume the parents that... Otherwise, he's not so sure that it's appropriate. He doesn't love the idea. There's another question here, a similar one. What about if the parent is a Rasha? The parent did something horrible. The Shulchan Aruch itself clearly says that in such a case, there could be permission to speak. The obligation for honoring one's parents is reduced somewhat if they have done certain things to their children. But does this include the Shach there? He's quoting, I'm just reading it on the top of the page, on page 6, says, though you can't cause tsar. You still can't hurt your parents. Just the obligation to honor them might be less. So he gives a fascinating reason. Rav Moshe says it's part of the refuah. Rav Zilberstein says, not only that, it's actually, we have two other points. One is, you know, that we want to honor our parents. We want to honor our parents. So sometimes we have to go through treatment in order to be able to honor them. It might require some talking about them in not necessarily the most respectful way to come to a place where we can then honor them again. So if it means that right now I can't honor my parents, but if I talk about them a little bit in a therapy session, even not necessarily the most respectfully, but it will lead to me being able to honor them again and healing the relationship, that could be valuable, right? It's like the chal of Shabbos Achas. You're violating one Shabbos to observe many Shabboses. Or he says, it could even be in the parents' best interest. And the example he gives here is, someone sends their child and they want their child to be healthy. And they want their child to be able to get married and live a productive life. So he says, if part of that, their ability to get to that point is going to include talking about their parents and talking about some things that happened, that might still be in the parents' best interest. Not only because they'll be honored, but because their child will be able to be a healthy, productive member of society. So that was interesting, right? Very, very, very profound way of looking at it. If the parent did tshuva, it's different, though, by the way. He says, if the parent did tshuva, and the parent has repented for what they've done and made it okay, you don't have as much leeway there. Yeah?
Sort of similar, but Paul's saying for Moshe that thing that didn't the parent to be sure this or said it of it, which is the right thing. So why would it be allowed for tshuva? Why would it be allowed to...
Right, so what is the reason? It's not clear the reason. The other post can give the reason. Eventually you'll be able to honor them better because it's in their best interest. Rav Moshe, that's what I was saying, that this sefer just gives the psak. But Rav Moshe felt that it's part of refuah. For refuah, it's a necessary part of a person healing.
That shouldn't allow the right, that
should. Right, so we'd have to conjecture about what was Rav Moshe's... But possibly, if as long as it's not derech bezayon, which is what he added there, then maybe it's not being over on the deraisa completely. We have to. It's all in the realm of conjecture. Fortunately, there. Yeah. Any other comments, questions, reactions? Right. In certain cases, a person could. Right, right. That is a challenge. It's a good point. So the initial chakir we opened with was we can do things to help to cure somebody, but what if it's what if they'll never be cured? What if, so? It's a difficult question. In many cases, the issues we're talking about, we've mostly been talking about, are curable. But what about the autistic child that we mentioned at the beginning? That child was not being cured. It was just helping them to be comfortable. Right, and nevertheless, we weren't allowed to violate a Torah prohibition of Shabbos in that case, but still a rabbinic prohibition. You see that there is an expansiveness here that still fits into that second category, where the rabbis are more willing to do things to help someone, even though it's not necessarily meaning that they're going to become cured, but it's still margia otam. That was the word they used. Margia, it calms them. Yeah, Johnny.
Speaking about lashon hara. the school suffering from mental illness. And the school, actually, the school just, let's talk about just in a short, that somebody there is suffering from a mental illness. And that one knows that the family have tried to fix this problem. Is it permissible to contact members of the family and to tell the family that they need to do something and get this person and keep them away from certain places? And that's permissible? Or is the approach to contact the custodian, the parents, the family, whatever it is, and say to them, you know, we'd like to discuss how we can maybe help together to work in a situation like this versus to put it across in a way that it's a big bother for us, we can't deal with it, and you know that you're causing a lot of pain to these individuals, mm-hmm. causing a lot of pain to this family and to people.
Right.
I just want to hear your opinion on that.
Right, it's a great question. I mean, one thing I left out of the sources, because the last few weeks I've had a hard time keeping this to an hour, and I've been feeling bad because it's, you know, it's late Sunday night, but there are a lot of fascinating Torah sources about the amount of compassion, and not just compassion, but respect we should have for people suffering from mental illness, and the love that God has for them, and the purity of their soul, and even some sources that talk about how the whole world is existing on the schus of people who are suffering and battling with these types of illnesses. So to be able to show respect to someone and to try to be one who's helping, I mean, if we look at just from the sources that I've quoted tonight, if we were to expand the response that Rav Zilberstein had to the fellow who didn't want to learn with this kid anymore because he was hurting his own soul, right? Because he wasn't able to learn properly. And Rav Zilberstein said, no, it's actually life-saving. You are obligated to sacrifice yourself to help him. It seems to be that just like, and if we're accurate in all these sources, constantly comparing not just mental illness, even person's struggle, as Rav Moshe did, with their parents, to literally to refuah, and if it's compared to a physical illness, then if you see someone bleeding on the street, you can't just walk away from them, or you can't just call someone and say, like, you know, there's blood out there, please clean up the blood, get your blood away from me because I don't want to step in your blood. And when you can rather, you know, call Hatzalah or help them out. So obviously there's, you know, it's more helpful to do what you can to be productive and helpful in the situation. Okay, thank you. Yes.
I know this is sort of a separate but related topic, which is the issue of treating minors on Shabbos.
Yeah.
When it comes to pikuach nefesh, we have a clear heter, mishum eva, for anybody that falls under the category of pikuach nefesh, which is fine, and I presume would work equally well if the logical approach we're taking by mental illness is the people nefesh approach, that they might come to physically harm themselves in the future or something
right.
else, then they fit under that category. But if we're using the so they could keep mitzvahs or shabbos in the future approach,
right.
then, you know, and that, you know, that data doesn't necessarily think they fall into the category of people nefesh.
Right.
So how does that translate?
So you're saying, so what about treating non-Jewish? This question came up last time also. It's a very difficult question. I mean, because you're right. From a technical perspective, it would seem to be more challenging. The fact is, in our modern society, and I was in a hospital in Israel, and I don't want to give details because I didn't get permission to publicize it, where people were asking a great rabbi questions, and a similar question came up, and this rabbi said, look, we live in a modern world, and we treat Jews and non-Jews equally, even on Shabbos. That's the requirement. We can't get away with not doing that. And we're not looking for ways of getting out of that. That's what we have to do, so that's what we do. And he was basically saying, in other words, like, so that's what we do. Like, I'm not embarrassed of it. And from a technical alumnus perspective, I mean, it could be a challenge, but we're in our society, we treat everyone I mean, because of the concerns, like you said, Ava, and one losing their license and losing their ability to practice, and anti-Semitism that would be caused. I mean, could you imagine? So,
I think from a practical level of standpoint, yeah. Most patients, at least that are hospitalized with mental illness, can fit under a fecal of nefesh category. But according, I was asking specifically according to the data, that is, you know, focusing less on the physical harm and more on the idea so they can keep more mitzvahs
right.
In the future, whether you actually see that pan out differently.
I mean, there is a value. It's true. I mean, halachically, it is an issue. People have to work on Shabbos. We have to be careful about what we're doing on Shabbos. It's not. I mean, we definitely do have to be careful about it and understand what we're doing. But there is a value to society. You can look at it as a value to society in helping people. We're not looking to violate Shabbos for this. I want to make it clear that the examples here are to show how big of a deal it is. So we're not encouraging people to have to violate Shabbos to help people, but the fact that you can sometimes violate Shabbos to help people shows how incredibly important the rabbis considered it. But, you know, there are cases when we're trying not to if we can, right? So let's go to the next issue. Great question. Let's have more discussion, but I want to just make sure to jump into it before we're out of time. So two more. One briefly, just because it's an interesting thing to mention, and I get asked about it a lot. This is page 7 here. You have here another tshuva from Rav Zilberstein. The reason why this is like a copy of it is because this is my copy. It's not been published yet. But I was just informed that a whole sefer on mental illness and halacha is being published by this author, and so it will be published there. This is the issue of cross-gender therapy. Yichud, can someone see a therapist of a different gender? Is that appropriate or inappropriate? Some argue the therapist themselves is tarud. They're tarud uman, tarud b'umanu. So a professional is doing their professional work, and therefore they're focused on their profession and not on inappropriate thoughts or behaviors. And in the professional context, they should maybe observe the laws of Yichud, meaning the door shouldn't be locked. It should be a potential for someone to come in. But there's room for allowing. Others argue, this is Rav Zilberstein here writes, and this is signed on by Rav Nissen Karelis, and Rav Arlen Steinman, and Chaim Kanievsky, and Rav Osner, and Vat Yosef, some of the great rabbis, that it's problematic, that it's prohibited. He writes that it's prohibited because the type of closeness, especially in dynamic psychotherapy, where there's a deep emotional attachment and a closeness that's part of the treatment itself, he is very concerned about not only yichud, but that the act of the closeness between a man and a woman who are not married is itself potentially problematic. And even more than just the prohibition of yichud, and he basically writes here that a person should not see a therapist of the opposite gender. In fact, when I asked him when I was there at Maine HaYeshua in Bnei Brak, oh, thank you so much. When I asked him, because they were building a psych hospital there in Bnei Brak, and it's interesting, you know, because just as a side point, I mentioned at the beginning that I wanted to talk about this because of the stigma, and I think just part of reducing the stigma is talking about it and recognizing this is something that a lot of people deal with, and it's not something to be ashamed of. It's a part of human life, just like I wouldn't be embarrassed to tell you that I had the flu, so I shouldn't be embarrassed to tell you that, you know, someone's dealing with a mental illness. But it's interesting because a number of the patients that I met in Los Angeles in my work, especially when Cedars had a psych unit at Thalians, especially when I would meet from patients, it would be that they were from out of town. Why? Because they were embarrassed to have them treated in New York or wherever, you know, they were from, because someone might find out and they wouldn't get a shidduch, you know, so they send them to L.A. Because at least you have kosher food, but no one knows that, you know, we're out of town. So it's interesting, when I was in Bnei Brak, I saw they were building a huge huge psychiatric hospital there in Bnei Brak. So I said, aren't people ashamed? You know, what about this concern? He said, you know, we keep it very, very private. That's one of the reasons. He said, also, we can't send our people anywhere because all psych units are mixed, are co-ed, mixed, and we need to have separate wards. So that's like a very big thing. So that's what he writes there. In fact, he concludes his tshuva here. I just think it's important to read this because he says, in the very bottom, you know, there should be a separation between rofa lemetupal, a female and a male. V'im yesher tzarich lihivaetz im rav beit cholim. You have to ask the hospital rabbi. It's very important to always ask the hospital rabbi, your shilas. That's what he says. I'm just following the Rav Zilberstein's psak, that you should always ask the hospital rav. So anyways, but so he ends up ruling, and the truth is, even not halachically, I mean, there is some chachma there, especially if someone feels an attraction with a therapist. I mean, it is a very private encounter, and someone should be wise about it and be careful. However, he does leave some room. If you read the tshuva there, he does leave some room for unique situations. And there are. And I was talking with a firm therapist this week about this issue, and I'll give you some examples. So in general, we say, you know, if possible, you find a therapist of a different gender, but there could be reasons why not. By the way, when I asked Rav Asher Weiss this question, I said, you know, someone asked me, they said, the world's best person in this field is a woman and he's a man, so can he go? He said, why is everyone the world's best person? Everyone's always saying, oh yeah, this is the world's best person. You know, I'm sure there's other good people. Go to the, he said, okay, if he's a 90-year-old man or something, it's not maybe you don't have to, but he said, you know, is everyone the world's best? Everyone's the world's best. You know, people always talk like that. Oh, this is the world's best of this. Everyone's the world's best. But there are some areas where, so I'll give you some examples that I just heard about. A case of a man who was in need of counseling, but everyone he went to, he was not connecting with them. And everyone he went to, because his rabbi said, you need to go to a man. He went to 7 men, none of them he connected to. And they were discussing in their group, and they said, you know what, I think that he would connect better with this one who's a woman, and he needs the help. So they sent him to her. While talking to her, it came out that he had been abused by his father. And he had issues with men and authority figures, older men. He wasn't able to open up, and he was able to open up to her. And it helped him very much. It was a case where, you know what, cross-gender therapy was needed. He told me another story of a case of also a firm group where they had a man, a young guy, a yeshiva bacher coming. He had anxiety, real serious anxiety, and he needed help with that. That's why he was seeking therapy. And one of his concerns was he was going to start dating. He couldn't talk to girls. He had never talked to girls besides his sisters and his mother, and he was extremely afraid of talking to girls. And they realized, they said, you know, in our group, there was like an Orthodox practice. They said, you know, not only can we help him with his anxiety, but we have a great woman on staff who can help him with this quite a bit. And that will also be part, he'll get a chance to meet a woman in this context. Of course, we'll be careful. It's in a context where there's people around. I mean, it's private, but, and they consulted with his rabbi and they said, you know what, it's a good idea. Let him have a woman to talk to deal with his anxiety, to help him get ready to start dating. So there could be cases where speaking with a therapist, I already made a bracha, just so you don't think that I'm not making a bracha. I had some water before I made the bracha. But we're speaking with a therapist of the opposite gender, or it could be. So we don't close the door to it, but it's a concern, something to be aware of. Yeah. Right, so yes, a camera helps with the laws of Yichud. The problem is, what Zilberstein writes here is, even if you follow all the halachos of Yichud, of avoiding privacy, the closeness that's created, even though nothing happens. Look at the word, he writes at the very last line there. He says, the second to last line there, he says, afilu banashim kasherim, a kosher person, shelo yavo lidei chet, he's not going to do anything wrong, b'chol zos, hakir v'hanafshit hazot, hi chet. Just that connect. So that's okay. So I don't think maybe Rabbi Willig wouldn't agree. That's his concern. Not everyone agrees. Definitely, there's a lot of post-game who have written that, you know, a person should go to someone they feel comfortable with. And we live in a modern society. Like I said before, people are interacting with people of opposite gender all the time. They should be able to be comfortable with it. So, you know, it depends on the person, the place, the time. It depends on those things. But it's a concern to be aware of. I don't want to spend too much time on it because, as you see, it's dependent on the situation. But let's go to the second to last issue. I hope to get to one more issue. But let's focus on one more. And then the last one I want to talk about, just as an ending, because I really feel like it's important to mention. This one is OCD, Obsessive Compulsive Disorder, or as it's called in Hebrew, Nervin. But OCD. That's one of the ways to say it in Hebrew. So OCD, scrupulousness, is an issue in the religious world. So we're on page 8 here. But it's interesting, first of all, to point out, OCD is not like an Orthodox disease. It's you know, I remember I used to have friends who like when I lived in Riverdale, when you have over Shabbos, they would like make fun sometimes, like, oh, you know, your kids are going to be OCD, you teach them to wash their hands, whatever, they're going to be doing all. But the truth is, it's actually not. So OCD presents itself usually in prayer and cleanliness, specifically in cleanliness in kashrut and the laws of Nida. But what's interesting is that when researchers analyze different societies, they find the same rate of compulsiveness amongst all societies as they do in the Orthodox community. Right? They've studied this. There's a great book called Sanity and Sanctity, where they studied it in the Haredi community in Israel, and they find not only is it the same rate in other societies, and also in religious societies, non-religious societies, and it manifests itself in the same ways. Cleanliness, you know. So they see that it's an illness that people have, just like any other illness, and it's not caused by religion, though religious observance does make treating it much more complicated. Much more complicated, as we will discuss in a second. First, let's look, so on page 8 there, page too far, when it comes to OCD, before we get into where are the complications, let me read to you what I thought was a great quote about how we approach it. This is Rav Yisrael Ganz from Kol Torah, the Rosh Yeshiva Kol Torah Matzesdorf. He's a Rav of Matzesdorf. He says, "Hine b'mekarim," see the little star there on page 8? "Habayim lifneichem benose ha-kfiatiyut," right, compulsiveness. "Choshavni shechashuv ledat," you have to know, "et asher pasku gadole Yisrael benose ze kamarana kilas Yaakov," the stipler, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Va'od, "Shebechol Marishal Safik Balacha Yesh Lahakel." You should always be lenient on people when it comes to these issues. "Vegam im yesh safik, im ze safik," if you're not even sure if it's a doubt, Lahakel, be lenient. "Vosif agon Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Shedarkei HaTorah, Darkei Noam, Vasosir Leze Einenu Ratzon HaTorah." Someone who's too strict on someone with this, that's not the Torah way. Right? Very, very powerful. So I want to give you some examples. So so Rav Asher Weiss has asked the following question. I'll give you a couple examples. Someone, imagine someone is told as part of their therapy, right? This is the more passive therapy, so this is simpler halakhically. As part of their therapy, they may not repeat themselves ever, right? Because that's part of obsessive compulsiveness, is that people repeat themselves frequently. They're told by the therapist, "You may never repeat yourself ever under any circumstances." Okay, in halacha, we have examples. Hey, it's tonight's St. Talmud Matzar Levracha night. We have examples where there's times when, if you know you made a mistake, that you repeat, right? Yalav yavo, there's different times. You know you did something wrong, you have to repeat it. What if a person knows for a fact they did a bracha wrong? They know, "I did something wrong. I am obligated by halacha to repeat it now. But my treatment is, I may never repeat myself." What do they do? Rav Asher Weiss writes, their therapy comes first in this case. Do not repeat yourself. You know that you are not saying the bracha right? It's okay. Hamevazvez al yevazvez yosher b'chomesh. A person is not obligated to give more than a fifth of their possessions to tzedakah, to charity. So too, it also applies to your spirituality. You're not obligated to give more than a fifth of yourself to do a mitzvah aseh. Mitzvahs lo taseh, a negative prohibition, you can't violate. But to not fulfill a mitzvah, you are not obligated if it takes that much out of you. And he applies to the story that I told you before of the Chassam Sofer. Violate one Shabbos, because hopefully this will heal the person. He says, and this is what I said before, the story I said. So he says, imagine, so you need to make Kiddush, but you can't make Kiddush. Let's say you get too nervous, or you repeat yourself too much. So you'll have someone else in your family. You'll have your sons do it. Your sons can't do what he says. Your wife will do it. Oh, what if you're having guests over and you're embarrassed? You're the head of the house. You want to make Kiddush? He says, don't be ashamed. Would you be ashamed if you had the flu and you couldn't make Kiddush because you're going to give it? Would you be? I think it's so beautiful because he's showing that sensitivity. He's saying, there's nothing to be ashamed of. So you have OCD. Some people break their legs sometimes. Some people get the flu. You have OCD. You have nothing to be ashamed of. Why is you ashamed? Let someone else make Kiddush. It's nothing to be embarrassed about at all. But that's with the more passive therapy. There's a more difficult therapy halakhically, exposure response therapy. The way OCD is often treated is you are forced to deal with the anxiety that's caused by the encounter. So, I mean, to give an extreme example, some people won't touch the pole in the subway. So what if your therapist said, you know, touch the pole and then lick your hand, you know, like something crazy like that. What if, you know, you're so afraid of meat and milk, so he says to you, you know, is he gonna say to you, so stick the meat and milk together and eat it? Well, could we do that? Obviously not. Would a therapist who suggested that be a good therapist for an Orthodox Jew? You see, sometimes, because I didn't bring this up with the Yichud, but it's appropriate now. So another question people ask me all the time, and I'm sure some of you get this question, is should an Orthodox Jew be paired only with an Orthodox therapist? Right? So I don't think that that's necessarily true. But sometimes, you know, it is essential that that a person have a therapist who understands them. Right? Exposure response therapy. There's also something called thought action fusion. That people who suffer from excessive compulsive disorder, they think that thoughts are like actions, and they can't even think certain things. But what if you have a therapist who says, "Oh, don't worry, if you just thought it, it doesn't matter," or you just prayed about it, you could pray, it doesn't matter. But an Orthodox Jew is going to say, "Well, no, but my thoughts matter, or my what I say matters." So the point is, if a therapist can help someone recognize that their OCD is causing them to not be able to observe their religion properly, but their goal is to be able to observe Judaism, then they're more likely to listen. But if they say, "No, don't worry about that, that's nothing." So we have to they have to understand what's a problem, what's not a problem. So I asked Rav Asher Weiss about this. You know, because you're asked frequently. They might say, like, "Oh, you're so careful about meat and milk," so the therapist is going to say, "So take your meat knife and, you know, stick it in the cheese." But you can't do that. They're not going to do that. They're not going to follow the therapy. So I asked Rav Asher, how far could someone go? So he said they could. He said he believes, for the same reason, violate one Shabbos to observe many Shabbos. He says it's so important, they could violate a rabbinic prohibition. But they should always look for a way not to. So for example, if you know what you're doing, you could say, for example, you'll go to the store, you'll buy your dairy and your fleishiks, and you'll put it in the same bag. And you'll carry it home, you'll put it in the refrigerator together. Is there anything prohibited about that? You know, we might not normally do that, but it's in a package, it's in a bag. You'll take your, you know, you'll take your cold meat plates and you'll put it on the dairy counter. Cold, it's all cold. So as long as the person knows, but for you that might be very difficult with the OCD, but you overcome the process. But it's not prohibited. So there's finding ways of doing it that's not actually prohibited. But I just wanted to share with you the Stipler. The Stipler Gaon wrote a lot about this, and he knew. He knew what psychiatrists write today. He knew it perfectly. It's incredible. He writes here, like, for example, someone would constantly be wiping themselves in the bathroom. They would miss davening because they'd be wiping themselves over and over and over again. So he gave them a rule. You can use 5 pieces of toilet paper and no more. That's your rule. I told you that as your rabbi. He writes this here. You read it. So, and he gives a couple of interesting points. He says, if you look where I wrote the 9 there, the paragraph below that, it writes, Enu mechuyav yoter. He writes, Aval e efshar lahaspir et ze lemishahu ba'atzavim metuchim. If someone's very anxious and nervous, you can't explain them all the reasons, why this, why that. Lechein tzarech lomar lo behechleit blitam. You tell them definitively, without a reason, what they have to do. And because if the rabbi starts giving reasons and explanations, the part of the OCD is to try to come up with different reasons why they don't have to. So you have to just tell them clearly. And he says that klal, and then you look on the next page, the line starts haklal. Chova gamor alav shelo liyos mishune mirabotav vishum talmid chacham. The point is that there is a mesorah. There is a tradition, just like there's a tradition in how to learn Torah and how to practice Judaism, there's a tradition in what is considered normal behavior. And we have to try to be within those bounds, and the rabbi and the therapist are supposed to help a person realize what's considered normal and what's considered beyond the grounds. And part of the way of looking at that is looking at what your rabbi does. You know, like the Catholics say, right? Don't be firmer than the Pope. If you see that the rabbi doesn't do these things, like maybe you should question, like, do I need to be doing all these things, or is this a sign of the mental illness? But the main question is, with these cases, is a person has to ask, is my compulsiveness, is it causing frustration or religious growth? Because it is, you know, imagine someone comes to a therapist and says, you know, "Oh, you know, I'm wiping myself 50 times and I wash myself 50 times and I spend 3 hours in the bathroom." Or someone says, "You know, I wake up every day and I wash my hands, first right hand, then left hand, right? And then I put on my shoes, but, you know, first my right shoe, then my left shoe, and I tie it, and I tie that. And then I say the certain words, and I say the same words every day. And if I miss this word, I say that word over again. And then I, you know," a person would think, "Okay, I have 2 crazy people." They're both, but no, one, you know, you have to understand the culture and the religion to understand when is a person caught anxious because of what they're doing, and when is it religious fulfillment. I want to share one last thing, because and then if there's any more comments, just because I just felt like I needed to mention one last issue, because I'm mentioning the issues that come up the most frequently for me. The last one on the last page here is anorexia. eating disorders. It's extremely common. I didn't know before I became a rabbi and I started dealing with it. But eating disorders are extremely common, especially in women. I don't know detail. I don't know statistics as much in this area. I know that OCD is not more common amongst Orthodox Jews, but it's common and challenging to treat. I don't know if eating disorders are more common amongst Orthodox Jews, but they are common. And it's a real issue. And it's something to be aware of. And that should be treated with the same type of compassion and respect and need for professional, respectful, understanding therapy. He tells a story here. Rav Zilberstein doesn't give a clear answer with how to deal with it. He has a fantastic chiddush in the first paragraph there on page 10 about a story in the Gemara that he assumes might be talking about anorexia. But he tells a story of Rav Shach, that a man brought his daughter to Rav Shach, and he said she's struggling with anorexia. And Rav Shach said, "You know, I want to give you a bracha." She said, "That's what I came for. I want your bracha." So Rav Shach gave her some food. He had his food in his office. And this I know actually was brought to Rav Shach when I was in Israel for the year, and he gave chocolates to everyone. And Rav Shach said, "Okay, please have something to eat, and I'll give you a bracha once you eat it, after you eat it, only after." And then he said, "Okay, now I'm going to ask your father for reports every week that if you're not gaining weight, I'm giving you a bracha, but the bracha only works if you're gaining weight every week." So, and because he said it in such a loving way, because he was an extremely loving, compassionate, kind person, he got through to her in a way that he said, "Wow, he really cares. He wants to give me a bracha, and he wants me to be healthy." That it had an impact on her. And Rav Zilberstein just concludes in his in his recognition of how challenging this is. Just look at the last line here. This is what I want to conclude with tonight. But they'll open it up for any final questions or comments. If you look at the last line before the Sikkum, on page 11 there, he just says, he quotes a few more stories, but the Rav Shach story is the one that was most powerful to me. He says, "Elu heina shitos shal tzadikim lerefuas cholim." These are some of the ways that our righteous people try to help people in need. "Heim lo nilchamim b'milchama." They did not fight a battle against these people. They did not tell them they were sinners and they were wrong, and they did not force them and yell at them. "Ela okafim ota." They would sort of bypass it. "Bidarche noam v'ahava," with pleasantness, with love, to show love, but to recognize that this is a real issue. And really my goal is just to bring up the issue, to try to take one step towards reducing the stigma, to recognize that these are all examples of things that many, many, many people struggle with, and it's a real struggle. And there are things that can be done to help them. There are professionals dedicating their lives helping them. And that sometimes halachic issues arise in the course of treatment, and we want to be able to feel that we are maintaining fidelity to our religion and to God as we treat them. And so there are ways that the rabbis have encouraged us to deal with these issues. And many, many times the rabbis are lenient in these areas, as you saw them state explicitly that the Masorah, so to speak, is to try to be lenient and help people find peace and health and well-being, and to help them maintain still this integrity of observance of their religion and compassion and love. And we should all have a sense of compassion and love. And just as much as we all value Hatzalah workers and anyone who's helping the sick, we should also value the struggle. First of all, have sympathy and compassion and camaraderie with the struggle that people face, the loneliness people feel, the intense loneliness and abandonment people feel from their community. And we should feel also a sense of achrayus to do something to be there for them, to show support and helpful to them, and know that there are a lot of people around us who are with us in that, and who will be there to help. And we should just know happiness and health and celebrate many simchas together. We've spoken about difficult issues, but